Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be hosting this episode. But first, I want to get your brain going again on the call for papers for the 2024 Summer Symposium. The symposium theme is heirlooms and new rooms. So the basic idea is that many of us have heirlooms, whether they're physical objects or stories or memories that remind us of our ancestors' struggles, missteps, strength, and faith. And often these heirlooms are helpful to us, but sometimes we find that we need to set one or many aside so that we can move forward with our lives, you know, build new rooms onto our spiritual home. What have you kept of your heirlooms? What have you left behind? And what are their stories, both of the heirlooms and your interactions with them? Are you creating new heirlooms? Do they draw from the past, or are they entirely your own creation? What kind of effect do you hope that these will have on your descendants? Of course, we're hoping that you'll take a wide view of this theme, you know, looking at it from a historical, cultural, or theological perspective. For example, what has Mormonism kept and left behind from its roots in American Protestantism? What have prominent Mormons done with their own physical and spiritual heirlooms? What new heirlooms do we see Mormon culture creating? In policies, literature, architecture, ritual, you know, the list can go on. And it can cover the new heirlooms that we connect with and the ones that we see as destructive. You can go all kinds of places with this. The main thing is, we would love to have you present at the symposium. The Sunstone Symposium is indeed a land of wonders. You never know what you'll find there. You know, a new friend, a new book, an old book. And that's actually what I found on the Benchmark Books table this summer. A book that has haunted Mormon culture for decades. A book that was held in the lowest esteem in my women's lit classes at college. A book that still has hold on parts of Christian culture. It's a book that has a YouTube channel with 12,000 subscribers and more than 400 videos. Yay, Even Fascinating Womanhood by Helen Andelin. Now, there are three books you can always find at Deseret Industries, or as it is now called, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Bargains. Those books are The Miracle of Forgiveness, Twilight, and Fascinating Womanhood. But I bought it from Benchmark because it came with the Fascinating Womanhood workbook, a rare find. It's kind of a DVD extras of Fascinating Womanhood, which I am still plumbing. If you've never heard of Fascinating Womanhood, I'm sorry, but I'm about to introduce it to you, and you will never be able to unsee it. It was published in 1963 as, according to the dust jacket, a guide to, quote, how a woman can win and maintain a man's complete love and devotion, unquote. To give you a flavor, here are a few of the section titles. Woman's Supporting Role. How to Ask for Things. How to Express Admiration. What a Man Wants You to Admire. Spoiler alert, one of them is, and I quote, how clever are his tactics in the world of men. How men feel in the presence of capable women. Spoiler alert, and again I quote, it is the most uncomfortable and humiliating sensation a man can experience. And my favorite, how to listen to a man. Yes, look no further, my friends. This book provides a detailed guide on that perplexing subject. These are only a few drops from the ocean of Fascinating Womanhood, and it sold 2 million copies. And it was written by a Mormon. And you can tell, she quotes David O. McKay and B.H. Roberts, and she tells a story about how some missionaries from an unknown church came over to a couple's house one day and how, after the wife followed the inspired counsel of Fascinating Womanhood, her husband joined the church. If you look back at LDS marriage culture during the 1960s through, like, the 1990s, you can see how deeply it was affected by this book, and frankly, still is. Now, the type of people who listen to the Sunstone podcast likely consider fascinating womanhood to be a hiss and a byword, a relic of bygone barbarism, a leading candidate for the dustbin of history. But I started reading it anyway, because I thought it might make good fodder for an episode. And as I got deeper into it, I started finding it more and more... Oh, you're gonna kill me. Fascinating. Both in a train wreck kind of way and in a... Have you ever heard of Peter Elbow? He's kind of a rock star in the glamorous world of writing instruction. Which means that only the nerdiest of the nerds know who he is. And just to help you admire my nerd credentials, I once had lunch with him. Yes, you may kiss the hand that touched the salt shaker that Peter's hand also touched. So he's the guy who came up with the idea of free writing as a way of getting ideas for your college composition essays. So you've never heard of him, but his ideas are everywhere. And he had another idea that's been working in the back of my head for a long time. He calls it the believing game. The basic idea is, in academia, we train people in the doubting game, quote, sometimes called critical thinking. It's the disciplined practice of trying to be as skeptical and analytic as possible with every idea we encounter. We use doubting as a tool in order to scrutinize and test, unquote. And the doubting game is very useful in our quest for knowledge. It helps us shunt aside things that aren't useful and find our way through difficult problems. However, the doubting game gives us only one way of approaching the world. I'm just going to quote Peter here. In contrast, the believing game is the disciplined practice of trying to be as welcoming or accepting as possible to every idea we encounter. Not just listening to the views different from ours and holding back from arguing with them. Not just trying to restate them without bias, but actually trying to believe them. We're using believing as a tool to scrutinize and test, but instead of scrutinizing fashionable or widely accepted ideas for hidden flaws, the believing game asks us to scrutinize unfashionable or even repellent ideas for hidden virtues. Often, we cannot see what's good in somebody else's idea, or in our own, till we work at believing it. When an idea goes against current assumptions and beliefs, or if it seems alien, dangerous, or poorly formulated, we often can't see any merit in it, unquote. Now, I'll admit that when I first heard this idea, I doubted. It reminded me of good old Boyd Packer telling us that we just needed to get up and bear our testimony over and over again until we believe it. Convincing yourself through brute repetition, staying on your knees until you believe, right? Right. But, being a good academic missionary, Peter Elbow was right on hand to resolve my concerns. Quote, if we try systematically to believe everything, we're not trying to accept everything. We're trying to find virtues we couldn't see before, and see which ideas look best after this scrutiny of believing. Our best hope of finding invisible flaws in what we can't see in our own thinking is to enter into different ways of thinking, or points of view. Points of view that carry different assumptions, unquote. It reminds me of my introduction to literary theory class in college, where the professor helped us look through various critical lenses. You know, new criticism, semiotic criticism, feminist criticism, Marxist criticism, structuralist criticism. And I realize now that looking through these various lenses did help me see new things. Feminist criticism helped me to see how various pieces of literature expressed gender interactions. Structural criticism helped me to see the play between competing ideas. Marxism helped me see how economics affected a piece of literature. It was really interesting to watch those things actually become visible to me. I didn't perceive them, and then I did. This was a version of the believing game. So, let me be clear at the outset. I disdain fascinating womanhood. It goes against just about everything I believe about marriage and how its participants should interact with each other. However, as I was reading it, I realized that the worldview it inhabits is kind of at the center of a lot of what's going on politically in the United States right now. You know, what are men? What are women? How should they interact? What are their proper roles? And of course, those are just the root questions that branch off into numerous debates about reproductive rights, LGBTQIA issues, and a lot more. I know what I think about those issues, but according to Peter Elbow, I could learn some important things if I read Fascinating Womanhood using the Believing Game. So, I'm gonna try it, right here in front of you. What this means is that I'm going to read some passages and summarize some ideas that will seem patently absurd to you and me. But instead of doubting, I'm going to see what these ideas help me see that I haven't seen before. It's a death-defying act. I feel like lions are salivating for my flesh on both sides of the tightrope. So Andalyn starts the book most Mormonly. She writes, quote, "All of life is governed by law. There is no such thing as chance. One woman succeeds in marriage because of obedience to law. Another fails because of disobedience to it," unquote. Which is a very clear echo of D&C 130, 20-21. Quote, "There is a law, irrevocably decreed in heaven before the foundations of this world, upon which all blessings are predicated. And when we obtain any blessing from God, it is by obedience to that law upon which it is predicated," unquote. And that's how the book goes. She presents laws and then shows how to obey them. But these aren't laws of physics, you know. They're laws about how males work. And a male is a most extraordinary being. Well, actually, he's the world's most predictable being. Let me quote. Quote, "Like every male creature, from the peacock and the rooster to the bull and the lion, he likes to strut before the female of the species and show what manly powers are his. He likes to enjoy the admiration which these traits arouse. But it is here man is most vulnerable, for his pride is extremely sensitive. He cannot bear to have his masculinity belittled, ridiculed, or treated with indifference. The woman who offers perfect admiration is the woman who wins his heart and soul," unquote. So essentially, Andalyn has a behaviorist view of males. Males have buttons. If you push the buttons in the right order and in the right frequency, and if you avoid particular buttons, you will be able to win their undying affection. Period. There's no complexity beyond that. Thus, quote, "A woman holds within her grasp the possibilities of a heavenly marriage. She can bring it about independently of any deliberate action on the part of her husband. So, a woman holds the keys to her own happiness," unquote. But the flip side is, quote, "If a man does not love with heart and soul, it is entirely the woman's fault. A man ceases to adore and cherish a woman after marriage because she ceases to do the things which arouse these feelings," unquote. In return for playing this game of Simon correctly, the book promises that a man will naturally and of his own will dispense, quote, "celestial love," unquote. Once again, quoting, "Bestowing such love is a real joy to a man, and he is more a man because of it," unquote. Now, what do you think about that? Oh, wait, we're playing the believing game here. We're trying to perceive more by inhabiting an alien point of view, so let's take off our doubting hats and put on our believing hats. Yes, I am a little insulted that she considers me such a slave to my pride, that I can be made happy simply through the pressing of my buttons, but let me believe for a moment. And I realize that to do so, I only have to remember my favorite movie of the year, Barbie. I would add a spoiler alert here, but if you haven't seen it yet, I mean, come on. So, do you remember that part where they're trying to steal Barbies away from their Kens? A Barbie simply plays on a Ken's pride, and he immediately zeroes in on her while the conspirators swoop in and steal away his Barbie. You remember one Barbie's like, "I just can't figure out the selection tool on Photoshop." And a Ken immediately bends over her laptop and starts paternally explaining how she needs to have the right layer selected. Another Barbie walks in on a Ken and a Barbie watching The Godfather and says, "I've never watched The Godfather before. Can you watch it with me and talk about it the entire time?" And he immediately dives into an analysis of the movie, completely forgetting about the Barbie sitting by him on the couch. These scenes are hilarious, right? But why? Because they're true. We wouldn't laugh at them if they had nothing to do with the way men frequently act in our culture. Appealing to a man's pride is a sure way of winning his attention. I mean, I look at my own psychology and realize that I'm pretty similar. It's like most of my brain turns off when somebody appeals to my pride. I feel the struts coming on. The interesting thing is, when Andelin describes a man's need for admiration, even when she says, quote, "a man's ego is a fragile thing," unquote, she doesn't do it with derision. She's just like, "this is the way the man is, girls." And she goes into great detail. About 100 pages of the book are focused on describing how a man works, with an entire chapter dedicated to a man's pride. For example, she writes the entire following paragraph without a trace of irony in the How to Listen to a Man section. Quote, "Do not listen only to what he is saying, but to the man who is saying it. If you can't comprehend all of what he is saying, look for the traits of his character which you can admire. In fact, if you only follow his subject and appreciate that, and not the man who was thus expressing himself, he will be disappointed. You may rest assured that he is not talking only to have his subject appreciated. He wants admiration to be bestowed upon himself as a man, and not as a mere talking machine. In his pleasure at having himself admired, the man seldom notices that his conversation is not understood. Even when he does notice it, he relishes it. If he deliberately talks over your head, he is doing it only to arouse your admiration. Whether she agrees with him or not doesn't matter. So she sits there and admires. Not his words, not his ideas, but his manliness. So long as she can watch the rapt animation of his countenance and the unfolding of his admirable character, she asks nothing else," unquote. And it's at this point that I'm starting to understand Peter Elbow's idea. Though this paragraph is the most ridiculous thing I have ever read, there's a lot of truth to it. Now, not moral truth, not you should do this truth, but plain old descriptive truth. I think if a woman practiced that paragraph on a man, he would indeed be in heaven, as the Barbie movie points out. When Fascinating Womanhood points out this aspect of men so bluntly and in so much detail, it's giving us distilled psychological truth. But, of course, the first thing that comes to our mind is, but men should be better than that. They should be more self-aware and work to overcome that aspect of themselves. That may be so. But that's us saying this should happen. And what Andelin is doing is pointing out what does happen. Men are driven by their pride and egos. It reminds me of something Daniel Quinn said. I don't know if he's as popular these days as he was back in the 90s, but he wrote a series of books, including Ishmael, Beyond Civilization, and The Story of Bee. One of the things he said that really stuck with me is that when you build a social system, you should build it for people as they are, instead of as they should be. Because a system built on how people should be will always fail. Because people aren't like what they should be, and therefore won't operate the way they need to make the system work. Too often we let our optimism get in the way of building something that will actually work. Fascinating Womanhood seems to be using this same path, basing itself on a clear-eyed view of how men's minds operate. Which buttons produce which responses? She's examining men with a clinical eye and mapping their responses so that women can use them to draw out her husband's affection, which she calls celestial love. And again, she does all this without a hint of derision. Here's another quote. "If you think it's selfish to want celestial love, you are mistaken. Bestowing such love is a real joy to a man, and he is more a man because of it." She truly believes that she's doing both the husband and the wife a service with this book. No one is manipulating anyone. They're simply learning and using best practices. Though she does admit that her pointers will work better if the husband is unaware that the wife is consciously deploying them. So, once Andelin establishes this point, that men are defined first and foremost by their pride and ego, an observation that the Barbie film affirms, she spends the rest of the book showing you how to push the right buttons. And here's the first button. Quote, "Accept a man at face value. A woman's efforts to change men are invariably unsuccessful," she says. "All it does is cause marriage problems and cause the man to rebel." She realizes that most women who are reading this book have probably been in a marriage for a few years and have a track record of trying to change their husband. So, she proposes something rather extraordinary. She tells of a woman who said the following to her husband, and just to let you know, you need to buckle up for this next paragraph. All right. Quote, "May I have some of your precious time? I would like to ask forgiveness for not understanding you all this time. Will you allow me the privilege of showing you that I have learned the importance of understanding you? I want you to know how wrong I've been about you all these years. I'm happy that you are the kind of man you are, and that you are not like putty in my hands and have had the courage of your convictions all these years." Unquote. And then Andelin gives a list of what the wife should do to follow up this kind of speech. Namely, quote, "Look to his better side. Do not use other men as shining examples, and express your acceptance in detail and frequently." Now, I'll admit that my skin was crawling as I read what that woman said to her husband. I mean, it sounded so servile, like she was bowing down and kissing his feet or something, but I'm playing the believing game here. So, what could Andelin be seeing here that I can't perceive through her alien language and worldview? Maybe it's this. I think anyone would be astonished to hear something like this from their partner. Because, you know, we so frequently collect defenses to use as leverage in the relationship, right? That's what the wives were doing in the book. They were using men's distasteful habits, behaviors, or attitudes as something that they could hold over their husbands' heads. But Andelin proposes that they let go of all the leverage they've built up. Just hit the reset button and then let the scorekeeping go altogether and make it a habit of focusing on their husband's better side and expressing acceptance frequently. I don't know, think about your own partnerships or close friendships. What would it be like to get that kind of statement from your significant other? You know, something like, "I'm so glad you are the way you are. I'm not keeping score anymore. I'm going to consciously look for the good in you, and I'm going to express my acceptance of you frequently and in detail." I think that would change any partnership. You wouldn't have to be of any sex or gender to be shaken to the core by this sudden, I don't know what to call it, like baptism? I mean, suddenly all your sins are washed away? Suddenly there's this new flow of energy toward you? Suddenly all your positive aspects are being noticed? It would be a completely new relationship. And think about it further. Would you reciprocate? Because that's what Andelin says the husband will do. Quote, "The man in these cases read no books, nor took any classes about how to treat a woman. The woman aroused his feelings and his actions herself," unquote. Would this button work on any of us? Is it true that attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity? But still, what a terrifying idea, right? Especially in a heterosexual, monogamous, 1960s marriage where everything is steeped in an unexamined, even celebrated patriarchy. Isn't that just an invitation for the man to just walk all over you now that you've given away your power? But then the book bumps things up another notch, saying that, after hitting the reset button, women need to give their husbands complete freedom. Quote, "More than anything else, men want their precious freedom," unquote. And once again, I'm feeling a kind of despair. The woman seems to be becoming smaller and smaller, less and less powerful, making all kinds of room for her husband. And will giving a man his precious freedom do any good? Quote, "Who's to say?" Andelin actually admits. "You must accept the fact that he may not," unquote. But since she has already established that a woman never changed a man, freedom is the only way he will ever improve. This seems an especially difficult thing to do in a marriage, since you often come into the relationship with particular ideas about what each person will do. And that was certainly even more true back when Fascinating Womanhood was written. I think it would actually take more for a woman to give a man his freedom back then than it would today, where there's more give and take between the roles. I mean, this is a deep letting go. In fact, it's starting to feel almost Buddhist to me. You know how one of Buddhist's main principles is that attachment causes suffering and how you need to cultivate non-attachment? That's kind of what Andelin is saying here. Let go of these expectations, even though, according to the culture, you deserve them. And that's indeed what the book is teaching women at the beginning. How to let go. Now, I'll admit that I'm still very queasy about the way she's saying this, since the power imbalance between the husband and wife was so drastic back then. But if I'm playing the believing game, man, this takes work. I'll admit that letting go of expectations, especially when they are consistently unfulfilled, is one way of being able to see things afresh, to get new ideas about how life could go and how to avoid unnecessary suffering. And again, what would happen if your spouse or partner gave you the kind of freedom Andelin is describing here? What would you do with it? Would you reciprocate? What would happen to the relationship if you did? She actually takes this letting go thing to quite an extreme. I mean, she's very married to the idea that men and women have different roles, and that even though women can learn to do things in man's realm, and perhaps even excel at them, it is unnatural for her to do so, and she should look for ways to sort of lure her man into doing them. One of her suggestions is that a woman do things in a, quote, feminine way, unquote, meaning badly. For example, if her husband won't install a cup holder in the kitchen, she should install it herself, but deliberately put it upside down. This will call forth the man's feeling of superiority and cause him to install it correctly. And if the wife has been taking on tasks that the man should be doing, she should back out of them. Let the lawn turn into a forest. Allow the finances to fall into complete disarray, etc., all in hopes that the man, having been given his freedom, will naturally step in. Now, I have to admit that Andolin's insistence on gender roles is very off-putting to me. I know how much I grew and learned about myself from being an at-home parent, which Andolin would have considered unnatural. But if we're approaching this through the believing game, what is the book seeing that is difficult for us to appreciate because of its rhetoric? I think it may be the human need to feel essential. When you feel like you're an important part of a group and that everyone appreciates your work, it's quite motivating. Let's go back to Barbie. Ken's job was to beach. He took it very seriously, but I think that he knew deep down in his plastic heart that it wasn't actually important. Which is why, when in the real world someone says to him, "Excuse me, sir, do you have the time?" he stops abruptly and gasps, "You respect me." He'd never felt like that before. In the world of fascinating womanhood, everyone has a role, and they can't pass it on to anyone else. They are essential. When the book was published, second wave feminism was just getting started, and feminists were, from Andolin's point of view, invading man's role. She admits that women can, as she puts it, quote, kill their own snakes, unquote, but to do so was to rob men of their role, which was what makes them feel essential. To make it a little more palatable, note that the way most heroes' journey stories start is by taking a character that feels unessential and showing them that they are cosmically essential, that if they fail at their role, the universe will explode. And that knowledge motivates them to do hard things. In Andolin's world, everyone has a role that, left unfulfilled, will make the world explode. Everyone is essential, even if some have gobs more power than others by virtue of their anatomy. So reading this idea through the believing game, I'm realizing that it can indeed be hard to feel essential these days, or even like your contribution is worthwhile and accepted. We take on roles because it's convenient, not because we were born to do them. We have to find our motivation elsewhere. Psychotherapist Esther Perel, in a New Yorker interview, said this, quote, "We have urbanized, and we have moved, and we have taken on radical individualism and aspirational materialism, and all of those things have created a playing field in which relationships are undergoing rapid changes. We have no idea how to handle them. Rules have been replaced by choices. But at the same time, we have massive uncertainty and massive self-doubt. What used to be defined by rules and duty and obligation now has to take place in conversation. And so everything is a freaking negotiation. You negotiate with your partner about what matters, where you want to live, if you want to have children, how many children do you want to have, if it's the right time to have children. It's an absolute existential smorgasbord. But at the same time, it's very difficult to have to define everything ourselves," unquote. This is true. Everything is a freaking negotiation now. We have few rules that make us feel like we're standing on solid ground in relationships. Living in fascinating womanhood world comes from, according to Perel, quote, "a model where relationships in our village lives, in our communal structures, were very clear. The community gave you your sense of identity. You knew who you were. You knew what was expected of you, and you knew how to behave. You had a lot of certainty, a lot of belonging, zero freedom," unquote. And I realize we are indeed wrestling with freedom. And speaking of roles, fascinating womanhood takes great pains to imbue housework with glory in a chapter called The Domestic Goddess. Quote, Women of high intelligence complain that homemaking requires no talent or special gifts, and therefore it offers no challenge. Why have some failed to find fulfillment in their domestic life? It is because they have not understood its heavenly possibilities. There are women who delight in scrubbing the floors and walls, washing and ironing and cleaning closets. Actually, little of our work is unpleasant. But when it seems so to you, it is best to face it with an honest attitude, realizing that the world's work consists of a certain amount of drudgery. Unquote. Reading this reminded me of an article in Tricycle, a Buddhist magazine, called A Yen for Cleaning. The writer goes to Japan for a week at Itoen, a commune near Kyoto where toilet cleaning was considered a path to self-knowledge. She gets to know a woman there who had spent her life traveling the world to clean toilets. It was, in fact, toilet cleaning that had brought about her first moment of enlightenment. She says, quote, "In my heart, I saw a big tree with everything in its branches. You, me, air, birds, flowers. I knew everything was related. That was my realization after cleaning that toilet." Unquote. So, once again, fascinating womanhood is sounding a lot like Buddhism. Drudgery as a path to enlightenment. All right, now for the last one. And I'm going to warn you, everything that has come before is nothing compared to this finale. It brings everything the book has been teaching into one final uppercut. Teaching women to let go of one more thing, their adulthood. It's a chapter called Childlikeness. I'm going to quote a few paragraphs here, just so you don't think I'm exaggerating anything. Now, put on your crash helmet, hang on tight, this is a rough ride. Quote, "Childlikeness is one of the most charming qualities in the entire philosophy of fascinating womanhood. It is a quality of sauciness, spunk, innocence, trustfulness, and tenderness all mixed into one. It is the charming qualities of a little girl. There are four ways we need to become more childlike. 1, in communicating our emotions to our husbands. 2, in asking for things. 3, in our manner. 4, in appearance. If you want to be fascinating and solve many of your daily marriage problems, you will learn this childlike art of communication. There is no better school for learning childlike anger than watching the antics of little children, especially little girls who have been spoiled by too much loving. They are so trusting, so sincere, so innocent and yet so piquant and outspoken that they are often teased into anger. They are too innocent to feel hate, jealousy, resentment, and the uglier emotions. When such a child is teased, she stamps her foot and shakes her curls and pouts. She gets adorably angry at herself because her efforts to respond are impotent. Finally, she switches off and threatens never to speak to you again, then glances back at you over her shoulder to see if you thought she really meant it, only to stamp her foot in impatience when she sees that you are not in the least bit fooled. One feels an irresistible longing to pick up such a child and hug it. We would do anything rather than permit such an adorable little thing to suffer danger or want. To protect and care for such a delightfully human little creature would be nothing less than a delight. This is much the same feeling that a woman inspires in a man when she is adorably angry." Okay, I'm going to give you a little mental health break. Breathe. All right. So, that sets the stage for Andolin's advice on how to manage anger with one's husband. Are you ready? Quote, "There are 5 alternatives. 1, suppress it. 2, release it. 3, self-control. 4, talk things over. None of the above methods of expressing anger solve a woman's frustrations without causing damage to the woman, to her husband, or a marital stir. The only successful way to respond is with childlike anger, spunk, or sauciness. This method causes the teapot lid to gently bubble up and down on the teapot. This is the only response that is charming, and the only one that will bring a man and a woman closer together. But wait, there's more! Quote, venting your energy with childlike sauciness is a means of preserving your human dignity, and it accomplishes it very well. You will no longer feel walked upon when you respond in this manner. When you acquire sauciness, you will find, strangely, that you will look forward to the times he offends you so that you can practice this fascinating art. You will soon learn to feel as little girls do, with all outward signs of anger, but no inner turmoil. He may even tease you into anger because he enjoys watching you. Childlike crying is charming, but the cry of a woman who is deeply and genuinely disturbed can be frustrating to a man. If, however, her crying is the innocent, showy, heaving and sobbing of the child, it arouses a feeling of tenderness in the man. Remember that human dignity is a quality of character, and childlikeness is your means of expressing this spiritual quality. Hello? Did you make it? Are you still alive? Stay with us! I'll bet you're wondering what in the world I can do with such a load of tripe. Well, this is not easy. The first thing that came to mind is that this book was written decades before marriage therapy was a thing. It was also written when it was very difficult to get divorced, and when the world was a cold, cruel place for divorced women. It was also written when the power imbalance between men and women was quite pronounced, so bear with me here. In a bizarre way, this tactic of childlike sauciness was almost an act of undercover feminism. It took the power imbalance and gave it a bit of theater, so that women could have more power in the home. You know, if they were already infantilized financially and socially, if they were already considered a second-class intelligence, if they were already largely valued for their looks, then why not leverage that? If it really is true that acting like a child will push a man's paternal instinct button, why not push it? That's the whole point of the book, right? How to push a man's buttons. It was one tool when there were so few to be had. If the world is going to treat you as a child, then take all the perks. Of course, I actually disdain this idea. It actually makes me feel profoundly lonely to think that the only way my wife could communicate with me would be through putting on a series of acts, that she wouldn't feel that talking it over would do any good, that, you know, we'd always be characters in a slapstick comedy. But it does remind me of one more thing. You know Eckhart Tolle, right? The famous mindfulness guy, the power of now and all that. He has a popular analogy about ducks. Quote, when two ducks get into a fight, it never lasts very long. They soon separate and fly off in opposite directions. Each duck then flaps its wings vigorously several times. This releases the surplus energy that built up in him during the fight. After they flap their wings, they fly on peacefully, as if nothing had ever happened. Our duck has an important lesson to teach us, and his message is this. Flap your wings, which means let go of the story, and live your real life, here and now, in the present moment. Unquote. I think it's feasible to see childlike sauciness as a version of a duck fight. It gives the woman a physical outlet for her emotions so that it doesn't fester. It turns the oblivious man on to his wrongdoing, and it supposedly pushes his paternal instinct button. Both parties then have a chance to leave the encounter without resentment. a series of offenses that could have built up instead get worked off through a series of vigorous one-act plays starring the wife, who has a sanctioned way of expressing her anger. And you have to admit, there are a lot of marriages even today that don't have such a thing. The normal thing to do is, you know, to let injuries build up until there's this gigantic wall of resentment between you. I guess I actually wonder how many people these days would benefit from these these micro plays where anger could be vented. You know, it's artificial, yes, but could it at least help? And I guess that's actually the insight I finally found, that it could be perfectly acceptable to find artificial ways to process our little day-to-day marriage problems, even if we both know that they're artificial. You know, we can have little rituals that allow us a histrionic duck fight to express ourselves for a moment, to let the other person know about their offense, and then, hopefully, to let it go, possibly with a little smile at the performance and a brief uptick of fondness. Because really, when we think about it from a Buddhist perspective, the thing that causes us suffering is holding on. The sooner we let go, the better off we are. Imagine that, something both Eckhart Tolle and Helen Andelin agree on, that much of life is comedy, and that the sooner we roll with it, the better. But I must say, men would make the world a much better place if they learned how to deal with the cry of a woman who was deeply and genuinely disturbed. There's one last thing I want to say about this book. There is a part of it that I have found to be very clear-eyed. And that is, in its foundational idea that the only person anyone has any power over is themselves. And she says it time and again. You are the only one who can change. Everyone else is out of your control. She actually writes, quote, "At the very heart of Christian doctrine is, it is ourselves we must change," unquote. And she's right about that. I think placing the locus of power in the woman is probably one of the main reasons that the book was so successful. Well, I gotta admit, this has worn me out. I've interacted with just a few of the ideas in Fascinating Womanhood, like less than 5% of it. There is so much in there that just makes me want to barf. But I know that you eventually get tired of the sound of my voice, so I'm gonna stop. Please don't take this episode as me promoting this book in any way. This has been an exercise to see if it really is useful to play the believing game when reading texts that are alien and even repulsive. And strangely enough, I think it is. There was actually a, dare I say it, this was actually a fascinating experience. But why? It's not because I found myself agreeing with the book's ideas. I wasn't slowly persuaded by hundreds of pages of text. I wasn't brainwashed by exposure. Rather, it was because I gave myself boundaries that forced me to wrestle. It made me realize, actually, how little I do that. Most books I read, I'm relatively sure I'll agree with for the most part. I sort of go along as if I'm on, you know, a fantasy land ride in Disneyland. Lots of stuff to look at, some thrills, but safe. But when I go into an alien book with the believing game, I have a completely different experience. I don't know if I'm safe. I don't know what I'll come up against. But whatever I do, I have to look at it until I start seeing it as its believers see it. Not so that I can become converted, but so that I can see things that my normal perspective can't see. And this is way different from normal learning, where, you know, you take the surface content and integrate it with your previous knowledge, accepting some of it, rejecting some of it. In this case, you dig beneath the surface content to find the underlying structure that it's built on. And then you start digging beneath the surface of your own surface content. And then you observe the world through both perspectives at the same time, looking in the same direction so that you get two views of the same point. So, the things I saw from my fascinating womanhood believing game include, one, that I am far more driven by my ego than I think. I hate to admit it. Two, that humans do have buttons and that they can be pushed. Three, that if we paid special attention to each other's buttons and learned to push them skillfully, something extraordinary might happen. Four, that pushing the reset button on our closest relationships might also make extraordinary things happen. Five, that letting go might be the first thing to seriously consider, even in situations where it feels impossible to let go. Six, that people need to feel essential, and that it's really hard to feel essential these days. Seven, that freedom does have costs. Eight, that it might really help to find a comedic, duckish way to dissipate our day-to-day problems. Nine, that drudgery might not be so bad. And 10, that I rarely think about how to work within a structure. I'm always thinking about how the structure needs to be changed. Andelin was incredibly practical in showing a woman how to get all the resources she possibly could within the patriarchy. This is how things work. This is how you put yourself in the most advantageous position. It's kind of like an accountant saying, "Yep, the tax code is a monstrosity. But here's how you hide that residual income." Playing the believing game also taught me how to choose to think within a structure. I realized that most of my thinking goes on in what I think of as the real world. I hesitate to go into other structures because I worry that it will loosen my hold on the real world. But if I learn to deliberately think in other structures and how to see their foundations, which helps me see the foundations of my own thinking, I'm not nearly as vulnerable to what I suppose the scriptures would call being tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine. And strangely enough, I really do think that the further from my own worldview a book is, the more likely it is to help me see something new. Not because it shows it to me, but because it gives me a place to see it from. Okay. I'm really done now. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode. We'll see if you come back next time. I'll talk to you again.